Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington, D.C.
The problem we have in South Africa is that the status quo, the government, the ANC government, and its supporters and the new black elite, the new black middle class, support, benefit from the status quo, and they don't want change.
South African President Cyril Ramaphosa says the masterminds of the recent unrest are being pursued.
Under any circumstances, maybe they could have shunned the event, but they showed commitment by sending a very senior member of a party, as well as the president himself issuing a statement to commit to being peaceful.
Zambian political parties unanimously commit to a peace pledge to ensure the upcoming August elections are without violence.
This was the only outlet operating in Addis Ababa. It was the only source of independent journalism in Ethiopia. And the fact that it has been shut down, I think, will just give more evidence of, the growing authoritarian drift now in Addis.
And the Ethiopian government suspends the Addis Standard, a popular English online news website. We'll have a reaction. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. In South Africa, President Cyril Ramaphosa says the recent rioting across the country's towns and cities was planned. Visiting areas in the KwaZulu-Natal mostly affected by the looting of shops and destroyed property, the president says investigations are underway to apprehend the masterminds. Local media reports that about 100 people have so far died because of the unrest instigated by the incarceration of former President Jacob Zuma. The former president had handed himself over to authorities to begin a 15-month jail sentence imposed by the Constitutional Court for contempt. He had refused to give evidence to an anti-graft inquiry into allegations of corruption while he was president. Moleti Mbeki is a political economist, the deputy chairman of the South African Institute for International Affairs, and brother of former South African President Thabo Mbeki. He says the unrest has dented the country's international image. Mr. Mbeki tells me that the administration in Pretoria was slow to react to the violence.
It's very alarming what we're seeing going on in South Africa. Really alarming. We have not seen events similar to this, I suppose, since the 1980s during the struggle against apartheid. So to have an event of this nature happening during the time of democracy, obviously, shows that there is something that's not quite right with democracy in South Africa. So I suppose we, all of us, now have to start asking ourselves, what is it that's not right with democracy in South Africa? And that's the stage where we are now beginning to ask ourselves.
A lot of people have expressed concern about the widening gap between the haves and the have-nots. And poverty has worsened sharply even during this democratic path under majority black rule. Do you share in that assessment?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. But this is what has gone on in Africa, everywhere in Africa, not just in South Africa. Instead of developing the countries after they got rid of colonialism and apartheid, they replaced the whites themselves, and they got into the shoes of the whites and of the white privilege that they had replaced. And this is what has happened in South Africa, whereby the new African elites replaced the colonialists and became the internal colonialists, so to speak. The consequence is the economy was being milked to enrich the new black elite, and there's been no investment in the real economy to create jobs in South Africa because this new black elite has been enriching itself.
So what do you think the government and the people of South Africa can do at the moment to address these challenges that South Africa faced?
Well, the government is deploying the army. And one of the other things that we are seeing is the emergence of vigilante groups who are now protecting their own properties and so on.
Isn't that dangerous?
It's a very dangerous situation.
Do you think the criticisms against the president are justified about raising the issue of ethnicity?
I think they are totally justified. The president, and I'm one of the people who criticized him in public, he produced no evidence. This is what we know in all of Africa. The minute a government is in trouble and the people rebel against it, they start looking for scapegoats. And then they find scapegoats amongst the so-called ethnic groups in their country. So we have to oppose this president and his government for trying to sow divisions amongst African people. Not everybody. The fact that I'm a Zulu doesn't make me a tribalist. Doesn't make me involved in ethnic. That it was a Zulu person who founded the ANC.
Now, Mr. Mbeki, so moving forward, what do you think is the best panacea to address this widening gap of poverty in the country?
Yes, you see, the government has been given by business people, by academics, by researchers, what it needs to do in order to grow the economy so that our economy can absorb this huge body of unemployed people, unemployed young people. But the government is not interested in adopting these solutions because the elite associated with the government benefit from the status quo. So that is the problem we have in South Africa, is that the status quo, the government, the ANC government and its supporters and the new black elite, the new black middle class, support, benefit from the status quo, and they don't want change, and they don't want to save in order to build the factories and the infrastructure that you has to be built in order to absorb labor and create employment.
Moleti Mbeki is a political economist, the deputy chairman of the South African Institute for International Affairs and brother of former South African President Thabo Mbeki. He spoke with me from Johannesburg, South Africa. In Zambia, all the country's 16 political parties have signed a pledge committing them to peace in the presidential and parliamentary elections. The commitment was organized by the Church Mother Bodies and the Center for Interparty Dialogue at the Mulungushi International Conference Center in the capital, Lusaka. The parties also pledged to focus their respective campaigns on issues rather than character assassinations or tribalism in the run-up to the polls. Analysts say they expect the presidential election to be stiffly contested between incumbent President Edgar Lungu and main opposition leader Hakainde Hichilema. The much-anticipated contest, they contend, has led to rising political tension before the elections. For more on the political party's commitment to peaceful polls, I reach Doreen Njovu Kabwe, Executive Director at the Zambia Center for Interparty Dialogue and organizer of the accord.
The goal really is to prevent violence, which we have witnessed in the past. You will notice that even during the campaigns, the current campaigns that are underway, we've seen some barbaric acts. I think we even lost a life. And so different stakeholders decided to come together with a goal to prevent electoral violence. And so that's how come the initiative to have political parties sign the peace pledge was actually birthed.
Well, I understand you will be monitoring these political parties to ensure they uphold their commitment towards these pledges they made. But is there any enforcement mechanism to ensure they are held to account for any violation of their pledges?
We have in Zambia the Electoral Process Act and the Electoral Code of Conduct, which spells out how political parties should be able to conduct themselves in an election year. So the peace pledge as a tool, it has no legal mandate, and as it were, it's a moral issue, okay? A political party can decide to even abrogate whatever is there in it. However, I mean, just the fact that they came up and then they reaffirmed their commitment to peace, they made those pronouncements that they would not be violent, they will conduct non-violent campaigns, they will conduct issue-based campaigns, they will not use tribal remarks. So the country, even the world, was watching and was listening. This document, of course, it hasn't got teeth to bite as it is with pieces of legislation, which is Electoral Process Act, whose code of conduct is embedded therein.
Some people are expressing skepticism about the Patriotic Front commitment towards the peace pledge because they said President Edgar Lungu and or the vice president did not come to append their signature. And they are saying it appears that supporters of the PF are untouchable when they engage in acts of violence. And that is why they are expressing skepticism about the PF's commitment to this. How do you respond to this? Do you think their criticism is far-fetched?
Yeah, so we were expecting the president of the Patriotic Front, who is also the Republican president of Zambia, to be in attendance to sign the peace pledge. However, the date seemed to have collided with his other assignment to swear in judges. So they were very much committed to the process. They sent their Secretary General, who came and signed on behalf of the president. And the president himself, I think, on that particular day, issued a statement to support what was happening and that his party was very much committed. And they, through the Secretary General, they were going to sign the peace pledge. And then they committed to being peaceful. They pledged to be peaceful. So really, that is a commitment. But as usual, you know, in politics, these are opponents. It's about power contestation. It's about who paints a better picture than who. So anything can come out. Anything can be said. Under any circumstances, maybe they could have shunned the event, but they showed commitment by sending a very senior member of a party, as well as the president himself, issuing a statement to commit to being peaceful.
Doreen Njovu Kabwe is the executive director at the Zambia Center for Interparty Dialogue and organizer of the Peace Accord. She spoke with me from the Zambian capital, Lusaka. The Ethiopian Media Authority, a regulatory body, has suspended the Addis Standard, a popular English online news website. This after accusing the news outlet of supporting a terrorist group. Announcing the suspension, the media regulator says it took the decision following complaints about alarming trends affecting the news outlet. But critics say the Addis Standard's coverage of the conflict in the Tigray region and other conflicts in parts of the country likely embarrassed the government and has effectively led to its suspension. They say the coverage sharply undercut the government's narrative about the conflict in the Tigray region. Opposition and international media groups say this is yet another move by the government to crack down on independent media and free speech. They say it clearly undermines the government's denials that free speech is not under attack. Rashid Abdi is an analyst with the International Crisis Group. He tells me that the government in Ethiopia committed a major strategic blunder with the suspension of the only independent news outlet in the country, which he says is likely to attract both local and international pressure.
The Addis Standard has gained a lot of respect in recent years because it has built, I think, a very credible and a very balanced profile in the country. It has been covering very much what has been going on in many parts of Ethiopia. It is a major source of stories, but also I think externally, because it's an English language website, it has been quite influential. And I think it is very sad that that outlet is now no longer operating. And I think this is definitely a sad day for African journalism, and also I think emboldens big style or big men politics in Africa to conduct this kind of arbitrary stifling of independent media.
Some people are saying that perhaps its report on the happenings in the Tigray region might have attracted attention from the powers that be that led to the decision to suspend or ban them. What is your take?
I think it is true that there is naturally, because Tigray has been a big story in the last 8 months. Addis Standard devoted a lot of coverage to this report. And also, Addis Standard has a very popular opinion page, which carries very critical commentaries on the war. And this probably is one of the reasons why the government has not been pleased. And I want to remind also VOA listeners that Addis Standard has also been covering the conflict in Oromia. And Addis Standard itself is actually led by an Oromo, Sadele Lema, who is a fantastic lady. This is one important outlet which has been shut down, not just because of criticism of Tigray, but also criticism of the multiple conflicts that are raging all over Ethiopia, including that one in Oromia.
Do you see the decision being rescinded anytime soon?
There is a lot of international pressure for the government to lift the ban. And I think also, if the government is being strategic, I think they would want to lift this ban very quickly. The longer I think this ban continues, the more it gives ammunition to voices even within the country that, you know, the Abiy government, which has just emerged out of an election, wants to now put the country on a more autocratic trajectory. And I think there will be internal pressure, but also external pressure to have this lifted. And I think the international community must also be very vocal on this issue, because free media is very, very critical, especially in a conflict situation.
Some are suggesting that this stifles free speech. Others are also saying that perhaps the government wants to control the narrative and have the only voice to the people. But what impact do you see this decision having on how Ethiopians get information as to what is happening in the country?
I think that government has definitely struggled in the last 8 months to control the narrative. Unfortunately, because the conflict has been very brutal and very vicious, the government has lost considerable, I think, popular support internally, but also externally. The tone of media coverage internationally has been very negative against the government. And I think this decision to also shut down Addis Standard wouldn't help them either. If the expectation was that this would help the government regain control of the narrative, they probably may have just lost the last hope of actually controlling the narrative.
Do you think this is a miscalculation from the government in Addis Ababa?
Big time. I think this is a big strategic blunder on the part of the government. This was the only outlet operating in Addis Ababa. It was the only source of independent journalism in Ethiopia. And the fact that it has been shut down, I think, will just give more evidence of the growing authoritarian drift now in Addis.
Rashid Abdi is an analyst with the International Crisis Group. He spoke with me from the Kenyan capital, Nairobi. Thank you. Meanwhile, Doctors Without Borders is calling on President Joe Biden's administration to pressure COVID-19 vaccine producers, including Pfizer, BioNTech, and Moderna, to help the world scale up the production of vaccines that fight the virus. To help achieve this goal, the group also wants pharmaceutical companies to share vaccine technology and to provide medical training to health workers. The moves, the International Medical Humanitarian Group says, will enable qualified manufacturers around the world to boost the production of vaccines to help combat the global surge in infections. To learn more about the call on the Biden's administration, I reached Kate Elder, Senior Vaccines Policy Advisor at Doctors Without Borders Access Campaign.
President Biden and the U.S. administration is in a tremendously important place in terms of improving equitable access to COVID-19 vaccines around the world. We obviously have been very lucky here in the United States in terms of the rapid availability in sufficient volumes for our domestic population. But the story around the rest of the world is incredibly dire. Only about 1% of people in developing countries have received just their first dose. So while we're pushing, upwards of 50% coverage here in the United States, it's a very, very different story in places where Médecins Sans Frontières is working, where even the most vulnerable people, frontline healthcare workers, have not had the chance to be vaccinated yet. So there's a lot the U.S. government can do. One, we can donate doses urgently abroad to developing countries that don't have them yet. Two, we can help make the pie bigger, so to speak, so that more doses can actually be produced. And that's what this most recent call is about.
What's the current situational report about this vaccination around the world, particularly in developing countries, including Africa?
It's really a horrible situation right now in developing countries and places like Africa where MSF is working. Only about 1.5% of the global supply of vaccines has gone to the African continent, where there's just very poor immunization coverage, very poor access to vaccines, even for the most vulnerable people. So in the places where MSF is working, we are not seeing adequate volumes of vaccines. We're not seeing the vaccines that are there being rolled out fast enough to the people who need them. And what does that mean? That just means that people are not protected from COVID-19 vaccines. And right now, Africa is in the midst of the third wave of this pandemic, where illness and deaths are surging right now.
There was an initial hope that Africa could fare better due to its experiences with such diseases in the past and how countries there have moved quickly to tamp down the spread of such diseases like Ebola and all that. What happened?
You know, in order to act quickly and to prevent disease and then to deal with it when it's there, you need to have the resources to do it. And indeed, you're right, Peter. I mean, there are many places in Africa that have wonderful, positive examples of being able to respond quickly to health emergencies. I mean, just speaking from the Doctors Without Borders experience, we support governments often to run mass vaccination campaigns against measles, mass vaccination campaigns against Ebola, as you mentioned before, can be done. They can be done very successfully in places around the continent of Africa. But in order to do that, you need access to the medical tools. And right now, Africa, for the most part, does not have access to COVID-19 vaccines. They have been left sorely behind in this global race to race of governments to acquire vaccines. So in order to be able to fight a fire, you have to have the tools to do so. And sadly, right now, the African continent and other developing countries around the world, they just don't have the vaccines to do it.
If the Biden administration adheres to your call and helps ramp up vaccine production on the continent, how significant an impact do you think this will have in the fight to limit the spread of the disease across Africa?
So we're looking at a response that covers a few different time frames, right? And we don't want people to think that anything, you don't create vaccine capacity, production capacity overnight. I mean, it is an investment. But the reason why we're calling on the Biden administration to push Pfizer and Moderna to share the technology, the publicly funded technology. You know, it's worthwhile to note, Peter, that Moderna had almost its entire COVID-19 vaccine development program funded by the public purse, funded by U.S. taxpayers. So the public really should own these vaccines. and the Biden administration should call in their influence to force these companies to share that technology. But the reason why we're talking about mRNA technology is that it's really at a huge advantage compared to other COVID-19 vaccines in terms of the speed at which you can develop that, the speed at which you can then produce COVID-19 vaccines based on the mRNA technology, the speed at which you can adapt those platforms to deal with the variants that we're seeing right now, with the proliferation of variants that people are certainly reading about. This mRNA technology is truly incredible for the potential that it brings for making more vaccines.
Kate Elder is Senior Vaccines Policy Advisor at Doctors Without Borders Access Campaign. She spoke with me from New York. You are listening to Nightline Africa on the English service of The Voice of America. I'm your host, Peter Clotte, in Washington, D.C. And coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, the Saturday music spot from our collection of music from the continent. But first, in Nigeria, defense lawyers for Nnamdi Kanu, leader of the Indigenous Peoples of Biafra or IPOB movement, has filed a petition seeking to have him receive medical attention. His lawyers say that failure to allow him to get help could put his life at risk. This after the lawyers were granted access to Kanu, who was recently rearrested and brought back to Nigeria. The separatist leader was arrested after jumping bail in 2017 and leaving the country. Information Minister Lai Mohammed says state intelligence operatives followed Kanu's trail for 2 years before his most recent arrest. Speaking to the local media, the information minister says Nnamdi Kanu was living luxuriously while in exile. He's been leading demands for ethnic Igbo to succeed and to establish a country to be called Biafra. But in 2017, the government designated IPOB as a terrorist organization. Local media reports members of the group attacked police stations, a charge the group denies. Attorney Ifeanyi Ejiofor is a lead defense lawyer for Nnamdi Kanu, the leader of the separatist group IPOB. He updates me in his client's medical condition.
We actually approached court because he's not getting the requisite medical attention where he's in the town. And aligned with our local jurisprudence, we required for us to get his expert to attend to him at present where he's in the town, because we want him to be given the best of medical attention. So that's why we're in court. And, you know, under the custody of SSS, he has access to his brothers and sisters and wife. He only has limited access to his lawyers. So in that circumstance, he cannot be able to be given the desired attention in the circumstance. And you understand that he was subjected to all forms of inhuman treatment and maltreatment. He was beaten mercilessly in Kenya, and which mental torture has continued as I speak to you. So we approached court yesterday to get the order of court to get his medical expert attend to him. Because without order of court, the SSS will not allow the expert to are ready and willing to give him medical attention to see him.
Some people are suggesting that since the charges against him are so egregious and that he has committed so many offenses, including what they say is terrorism against the country, all rules of engagement or rules that ordinary criminals have available to them under the judicial system might not necessarily apply to him. What do you make of such analysis?
Under the Constitution, my client Nnamdi Kanu is still presumed innocent of all allegations, as serious as they may appear, against him, until when those allegations are proven before the law court. So he still enjoys his full right today as a citizen who has not been convicted under the law. So he cannot. Those who are expressing those opinions are those who have convicted him over the social media before he will face his trial. So, but as I speak to you, he is still innocent in the eyes of law.
The International Human Rights Commission, based in Geneva, has cleared both Nigeria and Kenyan authorities of diplomatic breaches in the arrest and repatriation of the leader of IPOB, Nnamdi Kanu. What is your reaction to this?
You can understand that Kenyan government has come out to issue a statement denying the fact that Nnamdi Kanu was arrested in Kenya. So why absolving them at this stage? They've not responded to allegations against them, even before the International Court of Justice. So it's obvious that their opinion is biased and have been compromised. You have no doubt whatsoever that the Deputy Secretary of the United Nations is a Fulani woman and will understand their influence over some of these organizations. So what we are saying is that Nnamdi Kanu has been tortured. And Nigeria is a signatory to the United Nations Convention Against Torture and ratified the agreement in Nigeria in 2001. So the government of Nigeria and Kenya committed torture. We have evidence and also facts to suggest that the British government is in total complicity of what happened to Naji Kanu. And they were taking it up from the international level in the course of time.
Femi Falana, a prominent Nigerian legal brain, is of the view that the arrest and repatriation of Nnamdi Kanu is illegal under Nigeria's constitution. Is that your stance as well?
It's not only illegal under our law, it's also illegal under the Kenyan law. The Kenyan laws on extradition provided offenses within which a citizen can be tried who is being accused of committing offense or running from justice, right? Purportedly running from justice can be extradited. And the offenses Nnamdi Kanu was accused at the point he was kidnapped in Kenya, they don't fall within the threshold of this offense listed under the Kenyan law. So, not only that Kenya committed this offense, Nigeria, as well as Nigeria was, committed this offense, Kenya also committed the worst offense in this regard. So, in gross violation of its fundamental right, also gross violation of international convention and treaty, and as I already mentioned now.
Some Nigerian media reports that state security officials attacked your home, and that is meant to intimidate or harass the defense team of Nnamdi Kanu. Others are saying it's just a mere publicity stunt. How do you respond to that?
I had escaped two assassination attempts on my life. It's because I'm defending Nnamdi Kanu and I killed him. On December 2nd, 2019, my house was invaded. Over 42 persons were killed. Over 30 houses were burned by Nigerian security again. Then, as if that wasn't enough, on the 6th of June, 2021, my house was also invaded. Where my PA was killed, brutally murdered, taken away from my house, put in my own vehicle. The vehicle was stolen in the course of the attack. Then put in the boot of my car, taken to a place to call Miami in Anambra State, on Onitsha, and bolted the vehicle along with my PA alive, ablaze, eliminating my Nnamdi Kanu. I cannot defend my client. So what offense have I committed?
Attorney Ifeanyi Ejiofor is a lead defense lawyer for Nnamdi Kanu, the leader of the separatist group IPOB. He spoke with me from the Nigerian capital, Abuja. Still in Nigeria, the National Union of Journalists says it will continue to fight any attempt to undermine constitutional provisions that guarantee free speech in the West African country. It also says news outlets will continue with the campaign against two bills under consideration by lawmakers aimed at regulating the media. Analysts say the government appears to be displeased with what it sees as a surge in fake news and disinformation from news outlets. The bills would punish any media house or journalist found to be publishing misinformation or promoting public division or violence. If the media bills pass, journalists found guilty of these or similar offenses face up to 3 years in jail and a fine of 12,100 against any media house that violates the new rules. Emmanuel Ogbeche is the chairman of the National Union of Journalists in the capital, Abuja. He tells me that it is unacceptable for the lawmakers to seek to gag the media and by extension undermine free speech as enshrined in the constitution.
We have a crop of lawmakers that believe constricting the media space is the best thing to have happened. And it is surprising that these are individuals that benefited immensely when they were in opposition. The bill seeks to criminalize journalism practice here in Nigeria, and Nigerians can ill afford that. We've gone through dictatorship in the past, and one wonders if it's the same route where this same crop of parliamentarians are undertaking. We have demonstrated to them in clear terms that it is unacceptable, that freedom of the press is a constitutional guarantee. We are the only ones with the right to hold government and its officials accountable, and we cannot hold them accountable when you criminalize the practice of journalism in Nigeria.
How long will this campaign last, especially after the two-day blackout? Will this continue?
We are not going back on this campaign. We will be insistent. We will be robust. And we'll be demanding that these obnoxious bills are thrown into the waste bin. But if the lawmakers persist that it must be passed, then we will have to go back to the days when we had to fight military dictatorship in Nigeria. There is no going back. This isn't just about the media. It is about the people having a voice in a democracy. And once this is taken, what else is left?
But Emmanuel, some supporters of the bills are of the opinion that it is fair for Nigerian practicing media professionals to be genuine and to report or provide information that are accurate and that do not necessarily undermine the social fabric of Nigeria, particularly at this point where there is tension, there are insecurity concerns. How do you respond to such concerns?
The media has always been in the forefront of advocating for social cohesion and integration of this country. Right from pre-independence to independence, through the civil war, through military dictatorship, and a return to democracy. For anybody to suggest otherwise is being uncharitable. By and large, we have seen that the media isn't responsible for the gross corruption, for the human rights abuses, for the banditry and the general insecurity that presently pervades Nigeria. So for anybody to think otherwise, it tells you they are being insincere, and it is unfortunate. What I know is that the media has continued to hold government and its officials accountable. The media has continued to promote equity, fairness, and integration. And it is on that basis we stand, and we cannot do otherwise.
Well, Emmanuel, what is your reaction to the statement that the National Assembly Chairman of the Senate Committee on Media and Publicity, Senator Ajibola Basiru, who is of the view that the new measures to regulate the activities of the media are not necessarily to gag the media and not to undermine free speech or undermine the Constitution?
Are there regulations not in place? We have regulations. So when there is an amendment that seeks to criminalize a journalist's report that says you have to pay 5 million, you have to pay 10 million, you have to pay 20 million, and it is the Minister of Information has absolute right and authority over this and not the law courts, isn't that suspicious? We have self-regulated ourselves in this country for so long. For us to have the democracy we have, it's because of the responsibility of the media self-regulating itself. So the idea that it's a free reign, we are acting without any discretion, it's untrue. Those are just lame excuses, and they are unacceptable.
What will be your next line of action regarding your campaign against these two new measures that will regulate the media?
We will continue to push that the bills be discountenanced. We'll galvanize Nigerians to support free speech, freedom of thought and expression. We will consider all means legal and necessary to ensure that these obnoxious bills do not see the light of the day.
Emmanuel Ogbeche is the chairman of the National Union of Journalists. He spoke with me from the Nigerian capital, Abuja. A Zimbabwean environmental group is suing the government over plans to export elephants to China. The group, Advocates for Earth, accuses China of subjecting elephants to unhealthy conditions. For VOA, Columbus Mavunga reports from the Zimbabwean capital, Harare.
In an application to Zimbabwe's High Court, Advocates for Earth is seeking to prevent the Zimbabwe Parks and Wildlife Management Authority from exporting elephants to China. Lenin Tinashe Chisaira heads the environmental group.
Basically, we are applying to the High Court of Zimbabwe for a declaratory order that states that the Zimbabwe government and its agencies should respect international conventions, especially in terms of the resolutions that states that African elephants, African wildlife, should not be exported to destinations that are not appropriate for these species, that are not their natural or historic range. We strongly feel that there is a desire by some agencies of the government to violate those environmental agreements, you know, by exporting some of our species to countries such as China without abiding by the existing international legal framework.
The court application also cites the country's environment minister, Ngobizita Mangaliso Ndlovu, in the lawsuit. Zimbabwe's elephant population has grown in recent years, climbing to 100,000. Some farmers have complained that the elephants are destroying their crops and grazing lands. However, the Zimbabwe Wildlife Authority denies it is in the process of exporting elephants to China. T. Tinashe Farao is the authority's spokesperson.
These are just people who are trying to seek relevance. In the President Mnangagwa's address, he said he put those people on notice. There are people who are bent on saying a lot of negative entities. They must just prove that, this is what we are doing. The fact still remains we are not capturing any elephant for export. Nothing of that sort is happening. They must bring the evidence.
In the past, Zimbabwe has exported elephants to other countries, despite objections from animal rights and environmental groups such as Advocates for Earth. On Thursday, officials at the Chinese embassy in Harare refused to comment, saying they were not cited in the court papers. Columbus Mavungam for VOA News, Harare.
Right now, it's time for music from our African collection.
Oh, the fluffy senti sinan meruti tandale. Meshindo kuipa bima, nimeuza madale. Radio nyimbo mezima, TV ndio hatare. Meneja umebaki jina, nitakia tatale. Oh, le shabiki zangu. Waloni sifu kwa maneno matamu. Leo matu izangu ni mitu situ kwa Instagramu. Kimwa na statangu eti na yanifamu. Hata muna izi kimpigia ananifukia kama salamu. Na magazeti nyumbani kwa kuku savari sunajuaga. Utasikia tafarani timoni kwa zari amemwagwa. Na venye nilivyo nyonge tabia ya kwa jibu sinaga. Mana yona michambo ya matemu wa zamani nopitiaga. Nayo sema ya ramana. Sababu wakuna inejua kesho. Anepanga ni ravana. Ila mificha ni confidential. Ukisali umba sana. Mumeo nisije kwa kiche kesho. Mana rafiki wa jana. Dio adui mkubwa kesho. Ya poti, cheta pofika tama. Kadiriki atajapo kunipost. Pindisho zimekwama. Nankipata si jasi ni mikosi. Oh, jasi mezama. Mwela ni nusuru baba. Kama na mwana mwanangu. Roo yangu, tifada mbote. Anakwenda na mamangu. Kwa jaka kikweto na fukuzwa toke. Usilie sandrangu. Mwani yangu, jikaze usichoke. Wenda kesho zaune yangu. Tavuma tena mambo ya nyoke. Hey, na magazeti nyumbani kwa kuku savari sunajuaga. Utasikia tafarani timoni kwa zari amemwago yelewi. Na venye nilivyo nyonge tabia ya kwa jibu sinaga. Kama na yona michambu ya matemu wa zamani ya nikara.
No manja.
That was Music from the Continent, and we hope you enjoyed it. Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English service of The Voice of America. And from the rest of the Nightline team, Managing Editor William Eagle, Reporter Douglas Impuga, and Producer Saida Hamdoun, we say a big thank you for joining us tonight. And remember, as the elders say, a mouse that removes the palm nut that turns out to be the bait of a trap would already have known that the palm nut does not ripen on the ground. I'm your host, Peter Clotet, in Washington, D.C. Good evening, Africa.